Welcome to a Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're immersing ourselves in a novel that really feels like a spiritual x-ray of modern life. It's Walker Percy's 1961 debut, The Moviegoer. I think if you've ever felt a bit detached, you know, like you're sort of watching your own life from the outside, this is the book that just nails that feeling.
It's such a deceptively quiet book, right? On the surface, you're just following a stockbroker, Binx Bolling, around New Orleans. And yet, it was a seismic event.
Absolutely.
It won the 1962 National Book Award over giants like Salinger's Franny and Zooey and Heller's Catch-22. It tells you Percy really, really hit a nerve.
He did. And this wasn't your typical Southern fiction about, you know, family traditions and manners. This was philosophical fiction. Mm-hmm. Percy basically took the angst of European existentialism.
You're talking Kierkegaard, Camus.
Exactly. All of them. And he dropped it right into the humid, sticky suburbs of the American South. It's a fascinating mix.
And you can't really get the novel without getting Percy. I mean, his own life was just marked by this incredible tragedy. His father's suicide, his mother's death.
And he trained to be a physician.
He did. But then he contracted tuberculosis during his residency, which forced him into years of confinement.
And that isolation, that quiet space became this intellectual crucible for him. He couldn't heal bodies anymore, so he turned his attention to the modern spirit. He just devoured the existentialists.
And that's where he came up with the language to describe what he saw as this spiritual homelessness in post-war America. He gave it a name, the malaise.
The malaise, that's the key.
It is, and it's not clinical depression. It's more of a spiritual ennui, this deep, hollow feeling that everyday life is somehow meaningless, even if you have everything you're supposed to want.
So that's really our mission today, to follow this character, John Binx Bolling, on his quest to escape that very malaise. He's on what he calls a search for an authentic way to exist. The question is, how do you even begin to confront that kind of spiritual emptiness?
The stakes feel so high because he's not fighting a villain. He's fighting meaninglessness itself.
Okay, so let's get into Binx. Who is this guy?
Well, he's witty, he's charming, he's about to turn 30. He lives in Gentilly, a suburb of New Orleans that is pointedly unremarkable.
And he's a stockbroker.
A stockbroker, right. Dealing in abstractions and paper wealth. But his real job, his true passion, is just observing.
He has these very deliberate routines, casual affairs, and above all, he goes to the movies. He is, of course, the moviegoer.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just pin down his terms for a second for you listening. There's the malaise, that emptiness, and his response to it is the search.
Right. His quiet internal investigation into how to live an authentic life, he says it so perfectly. The search is what anyone would undertake if he were not sunk in the everydayness of his own life.
Everydayness.
Yeah.
He sees most people as just sleepwalking through their lives.
Totally unconscious. And his search is his attempt, however flawed, to stare awake.
But that's the strange thing, right? If he's so aware, why does he choose this life of movies and superficial affairs?
That's the paradox. He's stuck in what a philosopher like Kierkegaard would call the aesthetic mode. He's an observer, an appreciator of life, but he never actually commits to anything.
And the movie going is his tool for that.
It's more than a tool. It's how he makes reality feel real. He talks about needing reality to be certified.
I find that idea of certification so incredibly relevant today. His own life feels raw, unscripted, so it doesn't feel real to him. He needs a movie star walking down the street or a filming location to prove that his own experience is authentic.
Exactly. It's like needing an external stamp of approval on your own existence. And his attempts to break out of this are these little experiments he calls rotations and repetitions.
Revisiting old places, starting a new affair.
Yeah, trying to shock himself back into feeling something genuine. But they're all observational acts. They always fail.
Until his life of quiet observation gets shattered. It happens during Mardi Gras week.
Right. His formidable Aunt Emily steps in. She is everything Binx is not. She's Old South stoicism, honor, duty. And she enlists him, really forces him, to look after her stepdaughter, Kate Cutter.
And Kate is where everything changes. She's Binx's mirror, but a shattered one.
Mm.
He intellectualizes the malaise.
She feels it in her body. It's visceral. For her, it's crippling anxiety, panic attacks. She's recently attempted suicide because she's just terrified by the limitless, unstructured freedom of her life.
There's this instant dark connection between them.
Mm-hmm. It's deepened by a shared trauma from their past, a car accident they both survived. That moment of near death it broke the spell of everydayness for both of them, and it bonded them.
So Biggs starts this as just a duty to his aunt, an observation.
Mm-hmm.
But Kate's raw pain, it forces him out of his shell. It forces him toward vulnerability.
And when her anxiety becomes just unbearable, he does something completely out of character.
He acts.
He acts. On a total impulse, he takes Kate and they run. They get on a train to Chicago. It's a literal escape, what he calls a horizontal search.
Thinking a change of place will solve a spiritual problem, which of course.
It never does. But the train trip itself becomes this incredible turning point. Because on that train, Kate makes this radical, vulnerable plea.
What does she ask him?
She basically says, I can't live in this freedom anymore. I can't choose. You have to tell me what to do, when to eat, when to sleep, how to live.
Wow.
And it's not a surrender. It's a strategy. It's her desperate attempts to anchor her existence to something or someone concrete.
And Binks's acceptance of that.
Mm.
That's the leap. That's the huge moment. He stops being the aesthetic observer and becomes an ethical participant.
He has to make choices for her. He has to commit. He's no longer just watching life's possibilities. He's responsible for one difficult, messy reality.
Their physical intimacy then becomes just an extension of that spiritual commitment.
Exactly. It's an act of mutual anchoring. He finally finds a sliver of meaning, not in some grand idea, but in the simple, terrifying act of caring for another person.
But they can't run forever. They're brought back to New Orleans, and that leads to the climax, the confrontation with Aunt Emily.
Oh, that scene is electric. She gives this incredible speech, just laying into him, accusing him of nihilism.
Hmm.
She represents this noble, honor-bound code.
And she sees Binks as a moral failure, a zero. Someone who stands for nothing.
And you can see Binks wrestling with it. He respects her. He even sees the beauty in her tradition. But he knows deep down that it's an artifact.
It's from a bygone era.
It's a framework that offers no real comfort for the anxieties of his modern world. So by rejecting her code, he's making a definitive break with the past. He's choosing this uncertain, messy future with Kate.
So how does it all resolve? The book ends with this quiet epilogue. A year later.
It's Ash Wednesday, and Binks and Kate, they're married, they're stable, and crucially, Binks has left stockbroking. He's quit the world of abstract numbers.
And what's he doing instead?
He's studying anatomy at Tulane Medical School.
From abstraction to the absolute concrete.
Exactly, the human body. Service. He's finally grounded himself in something real and tangible.
And in that final section, we also meet his half-brother, Lonnie, who's dying.
And Lonnie represents this simple, unwavering Catholic faith. It's a kind of spiritual certainty that Binks, the seeker, just can't access. But it moves him.
The novel ends with Binks seeing a black man entering a church for an Ash Wednesday service. It's a moment of quiet connection, a hint of tentative hope. He hasn't found the answer.
No grand epiphany. But he has chosen a path. He's committed to love and responsibility.
So if we zoom out, the big takeaway here seems to be this necessary journey from the aesthetic to the ethical. Meaning isn't found, it's created.
Right. It's created through action, through committed relationships. It's what Binks says is left over after you subtract the surrender, the choices you have made. It's about stripping away all the false selves.
Which brings us back to that critique of modernity and certification. The suburbs, Gentilly, are a place of despair precisely because everyone is seeking a prepackaged, certified reality.
It's so prescient. People preferring the scripted reality of a screen to their own messy lives. Binks, the detached observer, is just as lost as the people he's studying.
And that's why Kate is the key.
Yeah.
Their love isn't a fairy tale. It's an ethical act.
A mutual decision to take responsibility for each other's wounds. Percy seems to be saying that real connection means bearing witness to another's brokenness.
And that can only happen after a crisis, after a disruption. The car accident, Kate's breakdown.
Yeah.
You need those moments.
As Binks reflects, it's good to have the props pulled out from under us sometimes.
It gives you some sense of what is rock under our feet and what is sand.
Yeah.
You have to get off the sidelines and commit to something real.
I think the novel's lasting power is that it suggests the antidote to despair isn't some grand discovery. It's the difficult, daily, concrete act of caring for another person.
It's so powerful because it validates that quiet human struggle to find meaning. It's a challenge to all of us to stop being spectators in our own stories.
And to actually participate. To choose the complex, unscripted world over the comfort of the screen.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.